Welcome, everyone. We're so glad you could join us for this webinar looking at the planned redevelopment of the U.S. Finishing Cone Mill Superfund site. My name is Scott Miller, and I'm the Section Chief and Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator in EPA Region 4 in Atlanta. EPA's Superfund Redevelopment webinars share valuable site reuse information, success stories, as well as challenges, with the hope that this information will inspire you to consider reuse on impaired or remediated properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the successful reuse of Superfund sites. Today, we're going to talk about how the restoration and redevelopment of historic industrial sites to commercial and residential use can provide area-wide benefits for communities and local governments. I will kick us off with an introduction of EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Program. Then staff from the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control and Scott Martin with US EPA Region 4 will provide an introduction to the US Finishing Cone Mill Superfund site. We are also excited to welcome Dean Morhaft and his team to discuss the developer's perspective on redeveloping a Superfund site, including the legal hurdles and considerations as well as environmental considerations. I will conclude the webinar with an overview of Superfund redevelopment resources and contacts. We will also make sure that there is time at the end for questions and answers. The EPA Superfund Redevelopment Program supports EPA staff and works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. There are numerous examples of successful Superfund site reuse all over the country. The pictures on this slide are just a few examples of successful reuse across EPA Region 4, from a dog park, a softball stadium, to an industrial park and a conservation area. It's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund redevelopment process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. The redevelopment of Superfund sites poses unique challenges in terms of protectiveness, stigma, and liability protections. However, they also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. While EPA doesn't own the sites or control local land use, we do help to return those contaminated sites to productive use, and it's important for communities and it's an important part of EPA's mission. And the good news is that EPA has a wide array of tools, resources, and support for local governments, communities, and developers to use on these sites. As mentioned, helping to return Superfund sites back to productive use is part of EPA's mission. Reuse aids in EPA's goal of protecting human health and the environment by developing long-term stewardship for the site and can leverage benefits for communities. Reuse supports social equity when community needs are accounted for, providing opportunities to develop strong relationships with the community as well as encourage equitable development and address environmental justice concerns. Additionally, reuse can lead to economic improvement, bringing jobs, employment, and increased tax revenue. Social equity gives communities a voice in decisions and an opportunity to address issues in historically underserved communities and or communities with potential EJ concerns. Environmental protection. It is estimated that 4.5 acres of greenfields are protected for every acre of brownfield redeveloped. Long-term protectiveness of the remedy and an opportunity to promote sustainable development and work collaboratively with other office groups at EPA, green infrastructure, climate change, resiliency efforts, and alternative energy and renewable energy. It also can result in economic improvement by removing blight and be a positive catalyst for positive change, increase property values, and leverage EPA dollars. Sales generated by businesses at Superfund sites and reuse totaled $65.8 billion in just 1 year, 2021, which is nearly four times the $17.3 billion that EPA spent cleaning up these sites cumulatively. So as you might have guessed, redevelopment is not only part of EPA's job, it is often the most creative and exciting part. Rather than spending millions of dollars cleaning up a site to just sit vacant, we get to help shepherd it back to productive use and maximize all the community and EPA benefits I mentioned earlier. It is the most gratifying and satisfying experience to see your site actually turn into a use that provides jobs, housing, recreation, or wildlife habitat. Additionally, reuse can help support community involvement and produce a sense of pride and vested interest in a site, often making the job of the remedial project manager and site team easier. The public can voice concerns and questions, and EPA can address concerns through remedies and reuse plans. Communities can think more deeply about what is actually feasible and what they really need, realizing big picture goals. EPA's ultimate goal with the Superfund program is to return sites back to a productive use in a protective manner. This slide includes even more of the successful site reuses across EPA Region 4. So as you can see, the possibilities truly can be endless. Some local governments and community members and developers think that a site is not ready for reuse until the cleanup is done. Not true. In fact, the earlier EPA can identify the end use and redeveloper, the better. Many sites can be partially reused during the cleanup. EPA, local governments, and developers can coordinate during cleanups to maximize both cleanup and reuse benefits. For example, planned parking lots can be used as caps for contamination, or monitoring wells may be located to allow better reuse of the property. It's also possible for the prospective purchaser to agree to take on part of the cleanup to meet their project timeline or goals. EPA implements its best remedies when it receives reuse information as early in the cleanup process as possible, but this may not always be possible, especially for older sites. EPA benefits from reuse information at any stage of the cleanup process because EPA continues to evaluate and ensure sites meet protectiveness standards. EPA understands that local governments, especially those in environmental justice communities, are often resource-strapped and may not have a lot of experience with Superfund sites. That's okay. EPA is here to help. EPA has lots of tools, resources, and support for local governments, community members, and developers who want to get these sites back into productive use. With that said, I'm going to pass it off to Scott Martin, Ken Taylor, Gary Stewart, and Susan Fulmer to give you an introduction to the U.S. Finishing Cone Mill Superfund site in Greenville, South Carolina. Thank you.
Good afternoon and good morning, everybody. Welcome to the webinar today. And as South Carolina DHEC, I want to share that this has been a site we've had a long history with, both before EPA's involvement and through EPA's involvement, and now into the next phase. Next slide, please. We really want to share the story today of a mill that was built early in the 1900s. On the left, you'll see if the mill is in the kind of bottom right area, the long northeast southwest looking structure. And it was a typical mill village back in the day. That, a lot of these houses are still there, that village is there. But today, you just have a desolate looking manufacturing site surrounded by the remnants of the mill village. And what we're so encouraged about is the collaborative working and the ideas and how to take an MPL status site now today and look at the future to restore this community. And so with that, I'm going to pass it on to the rest of my team and to kind of give you a history of the site from the DHEC perspective and then from EPA's perspective. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Stewart, and I'm going to talk briefly about the history of the site and DHEC's involvement. The facility was originally called Union Bleachery and Finishing Company. It was constructed in 1902 on the banks of Langston Creek, and this is about 3 miles north of downtown Greenville. At that time, Union Bleachery was the smallest mill in an area that was flourishing with mills, and it was actually affectionately referred to as the textile capital of the world. Operations at the facility included bleaching, dyeing, and finishing. Plant struggled in its first few years, but by 1910, Union Bleachery was one of the most robust and successful mills in the upstate of South Carolina. Next. This figure shows the site and the area around it. The main mill is the pinkish purplish area just to the right of the center of the picture. Langston Creek comes in from the top right of the picture down to the bottom center, and the Reedy River comes in from the top left and joins with Langston Creek near the bottom of the photo. Right in the center of the photo is the old mill village, the houses and all that are mostly still intact. A couple of other notable things on the figure: the Northern Reservoir and the Northwestern Reservoir, those were used to provide water for the operations at the facility. Next. I'm going to talk very briefly about the Union Bleachery as it started with the Arrington family, but I will come back to this slide in just a moment. Next. One of the things that was very common in the mills of the late 1800s and early 1900s was the sense of community. The communities around the mills were often just mill workers and their families. Employees were affectionately referred to as lint heads, and they took that as a badge of honor. And lint heads that I know today still take that as a badge of honor. But they lived, worked, and worshiped in the community. John Arrington, who was the early operator of the facility, and his family, he ensured there were schools, churches, community buildings, playgrounds, and here he even had a golf course. The mill was known for sponsoring sports teams and Christmas parties, barbecues, and other events. One thing John Arrington did was make sure he looked out for his workers and ensured they had that sense of community pride. Next. So the operational history, as I mentioned, Union Bleachery was the original name, and it was operated by the Arrington family until 1947. From 1947 to 1952, the Aspinook Corporation operated the facility. And then from 1952 to 1984, Cone Mills Corporation operated. And Cone was a big player in the environmental part of the early environmental response actions that went on at the facility. From 1984 to 2003, American Fast Print Limited operated the facility. In November of 2003, the main plant was partially destroyed by a fire and the facility shut down at that time. Next. So the regulatory history really begins in the early 1980s. Cone Mills began investigating contamination in soil, groundwater, and surface water there at Langston Creek. And this photo shows a picture of well water that was highly contaminated with chromium. So in 1982, Cone Mills began operating a groundwater treatment system, and that was to address groundwater contamination adjacent to the creek. Next. In 1984, Cone Mills sold the property, but they and American Fast Print, the new buyer, entered into a joint consent order with the department. Among other things, it required continuing groundwater treatment by Cone Mills. It did not place that obligation on American Fast Print. So Cone Mills continued operating the facility during the 1980s, excuse me, operating the treatment system during the 1980s, and the parties jointly conducted investigations of the site. In 1991, an RI report was submitted, and I put RI in quotes there because it was not a remedial investigation to CERCLA standards, but it did identify significant contamination. In 1994 and 1995, the companies conducted a soil removal that included over 13,000 tons of contaminated material. In 2004, Cone Mills filed for bankruptcy protection and shut off the treatment system. And in June of 2004, the site was transferred from DHEC's water program to our state Superfund program. Next. In December 2004, DHEC filed a complaint in federal court against American Fast Print. The reason we did that was as soon as it came into our state Superfund program, we notified the parties of their potential liability, but they had no interest in conducting work under an order or an agreement with the department. So we filed the complaint, and in July of 2005, we amended the complaint and added Duke Energy, which operated a electrical substation on the property and Piper Properties, who had bought a portion of the property. Duke had agreed to, under the settlement, to remove contaminated soil in the PCB area and make a payment to DHEC toward our past costs. American Fast Print and Piper Properties agreed to conduct a remedial investigation and feasibility study, as well as conduct remedial design and remedial action activities. Next. As we expected, American Fast Print and Piper failed to conduct the required response actions. So in 2008 and 2009, DHEC filed motions to appoint a receiver. And the receiver's main activities were to market the property to try to get money to help address contamination issues and to maintain security. Concurrent with these activities, DHEC's site assessment group was conducting pre-remedial assessment activities to support a potential listing on the national priorities list. And in 2011, the site was listed on the NPL and lead agency activities were transferred to EPA. And that's a brief history of DHEC's involvement.
Hello, my name is Scott Martin. I am a remedial project manager in the US EPA Region 4 office in Atlanta, Georgia. And Scott Miller is actually my section chief. And I've been the remedial project manager on this site since it became a Superfund site back in 2011. And I'm just gonna give you a short overview of EPA involvement. Next slide, please. As already been mentioned, the site has a long history in Greenville, South Carolina. It operated for over 100 years as various forms of textile mill owned by several different corporations over the years. And the state of South Carolina, as you saw on the previous slides, has had a long interaction with the facility. Next slide, please. So as mentioned, there was a fire in 2003, which destroyed the main plant facility and essentially caused the facility to shut down. And it was essentially abandoned. There were no real owners or bankruptcy to go for. And eventually in 2011, the EPA listed the site on the national priorities list, which then does open it up to coming into the Superfund program. It is listed as a fund lead site, which means that normally EPA would cover the costs of remedial action. But this may be a different case with the developer coming on board. In 2011, at the same time it was listed on the national priorities list, our group called Emergency Response and Removal started we call a time critical removal action to finish tearing down the remains of the burned out facility building because there was friable asbestos, which was exposed to the environment. And humans could potentially be exposed to that asbestos. And so they initiated a time critical removal to tear down the building. At the same time, since it's such a large site overall, my group began a site-wide remedial investigation off-site and worked our way towards the main facility once the emergency response removal group finished their action. Next slide. I think we mentioned the site is approximately 2.5 miles north of downtown Greenville, South Carolina, which is Greenville downtown has undergone a pretty major redevelopment over the past few years. And that redevelopment is expanding towards the site. In the EPA, we have, to sort of manage the size of the site, we divided it into three operable units, with OU1 being the main facility. I sometimes refer to that as inside the fence line. And then OU2 is the outlying areas or the areas off the main facility. And then operable unit three will be the site-wide groundwater. The site is currently not in reuse, which we're hoping to change soon. A few years ago, the site was listed on EPA's top 20 list of sites with potential reuse. And a couple years ago, I was in the middle of preparing a site-wide record of decision to move forward with remedial action at the site. And I was EPA was approached by a local marketing firm out of Greenville that wanted to market the site for sale. And that eventually drew in the presenters that you'll see in a few minutes that we are now working to redevelop the site with them. And so that sort of changed our course of action. And instead of doing a site-wide ROD, I'm now doing multiple records of decision, try to speed up the process of clearing areas for redevelopment. Last year, there were over approximately 150 acres of the site were eligible for no action under the Superfund program. So we did a record of decision of no action, and then we moved forward with a partial delisting from the national priorities list for those parcels. This year, we just issued a proposed plan for the OU1 main facility, and the comment period on that closed a couple weeks ago, and we are now working to finalize a record of decision for that portion. And then we'll then again do a partial delisting of the soils portion in the near future. And then we will follow that up with another record of decision for operable unit three, the groundwater. Next slide, please. So this slide, you can see the areas that are kind of the dashed greenish lines. Those are the two areas that are each about 75 acres in size that we delisted last year. And then the area that's in the white solid line, it will be the main facility record of decision that we'll be issuing soon, just covering the soils. And then you can see there, kind of in the dotted brownish line, is the main facility itself. The record of decision intends to finish tearing down the main facility so that we can get to the soils that are underneath there that we, due to conditions at the site, we have not been able to sample underneath there. And so the theory is that there still must be soils or some other source underneath the building that still serves as a source to chromium for groundwater contamination, because there still is at least one set of wells that when you sample the groundwater there, you get that yellowish water that you saw on the previous slides. And then quite a bit of the rest of the portion of the OU1 record of decision, like I said, will be eligible for no action, and we'll move to delist that area this year. And I think that's all I really had, so I will pass on to the next presenter. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. And sorry in advance for my voice, everybody. My name is Dean Warhaft, and I'm one of the co-developers along with Warren Zinn. We'll go back and forth through this portion of the presentation, kind of giving you some information about the developer's perspective and framework for planning the redevelopment of a site like this.
Next slide.
So you've heard a significant amount about the history of the site. You can kind of see here here's images of the textile mill in its heyday prior to the fire, and then really what's left of the textile mill itself today. You can go to the next slide. Thank you. Again, you've got images that are showing you the history of the site and, you know, work and what went on the site and kind of the beauty and allure of these wonderful places and what they look like when they were in their heyday and then the remnants of what's left of them today. So the past, as you heard before, these were vibrant places, social, there were, you know, real communities. And then, of course, presently, these are abandoned environmental sites where, you know, the one word that really describes it is blight. And the real opportunity is how do you turn these vast locations back into something that's really vibrant, that the community can then live, work, play, and enjoy going into the future. And so you can see that here. So the first thing, obviously, is to really understand the current condition of the site. You heard a lot about the current conditions from DHEC and the EPA. And with that, you can understand that there are both environmental concerns as well as just debris concerns with a site like this. In 2003, there was a fire. There was another major fire in 2017 where the main facility burned down. And when it burned down, all of the debris that was collected was actually put in a landfill on site. So these are things that as a developer, then you have to deal with these other issues if you're looking to redevelop a site like this. Again, you can see that, you know, it's overgrown. So where it was once a place of commerce, you know, once left untouched, nature comes back in and takes the place back over. So that's also what you're seeing here, is that nature really came back in and took this place back over. Again, some more remnant images kind of really gives you a feel. So master planning and visioning of the site. Really, it's about getting together and understanding what it takes to take these large, vast sites and understand how to break them into their smaller pieces, but then have those smaller pieces still communicate with each other, like you would do in any other master planning process. And so when you do that, the idea is take the history of a place and then reweave that history back in to the future of that place. So here you actually have the hole in the donut is filled. And so it's really about creating the donut around that hole. And just for perspective of the size of this site, if you were to take this site and you were to overlay it on downtown Greenville, this essentially circle is about the exact same size as the city of Greenville, the downtown urban area. Warren?
So the question is, how did we get to this master plan? And what we did was the first thing we did was listened. You know, there's an old adage, don't tell the market what it wants. Listen to what the market wants. So here we went out and started at, you know, the most granular level and met with the community associations in the neighborhood, the Sanssouci Alliance, met with the local community leaders and said, you know, what do you all envision for this site? We didn't want to come in as some developers, take over the site and tell them what we're going to do there. We wanted to hear what they wanted. And that's what helped us begin the framework for the master plan that you saw in the previous slide. You know, with an environmental Superfund site, it's already a touchy subject for the local community to begin with. And so it's imperative from our perspective not to come in immediately and just start making waves, go the other way around, listen to the community and build from them. And the truth is they already had a master plan done for the community and for this site. And most of what you see here began with their building blocks. We didn't deviate much from what they had originally planned. You go ahead, Dean.
So, you know, that's a really good point about like the local community buy-in and the support that you're able to generate with the vision that the community has already created. The other piece of that is also bringing in local and national consultants. The local consultants, what they end up doing is they bring this special history and knowledge and appreciation of the site and its relationship to the community. And by doing that, you're able to kind of bridge this gap and find these ways to take the historic and the future and kind of bring those pieces together with a site like this, where you've got an existing mill village and you have people whose parents and parents' parents were a part of this textile mill or a part of the textile crescent in general, which is what this area of the upstate is referred to. And how do you take that history and not lose it by just bulldozing the entire property and starting fresh, but also tell that story and honor that past as you carry the development into the future?
So one of the other important lessons that we took away from this whole process so far is that obviously the EPA and DHEC are two major governmental players as part of the process, but without heavily involving the local government, the city government, the county government, the local associations, the project never would have happened. You have to build a consensus amongst all the governmental entities, and we had to rely heavily on the local government to help make this project come to fruition. I mean, we all know one of the biggest challenges with EPA Superfund sites is funding and, you know, waiting for Congress to do anything, let alone fund Superfund sites. So, you know, to make sites like this happen, we had to put together, you know, what you'd call a cap stack and a development deal, but really a government stack of what we can, what, you know, benefits and you know, assistance we can get from different various government entities, put that all together and get everybody working together from Charleston County Council all the way up, you know, to the EPA in DC. And that really putting that team together and working with all those groups. And that's where using the local consultants come in, because, you know, Dean and I are developers from Miami. We've obviously spent a lot of time in the upstate, but we're by no means local. You know, when you bring in an architecture firm that has its roots in town, that you know, members of the firm have been there their entire lives and know personally everybody in town, that makes a big difference when you go and meet with the community there to try to get things done. Go ahead, Dean.
So like Warren started to say, the $1 million, or in this case, multi-million-dollar question is, how do you pay for these kinds of sites? And what Warren and I have found is that, you know, too many developers seem to approach these types of projects where they come in with their handout from the beginning, as opposed to being willing to commit that capital that Warren was just discussing, and really find ways to develop the site, which require spending money. A lot of times it's on due diligence in the beginning, but really spending your own capital, your own dollars, in order to really delve into the issues and create the creativity that's necessary to make these redevelopment projects work. And so this is really focusing on a true public-private partnership, because in the end, it never matters who owns the land on projects of this size or scale. It's always a public-private partnership. It truly is. It doesn't matter whether you're the developer and you own the land, whether the land is owned by the city, the county, the state. Ultimately, these large projects require a lot of buy-in by the community, and that community includes many, many public entities. So you really got to understand that piece first, and the developer themselves has to be willing to put out those initial capital dollars to try and delve into those issues and how to break it apart and then put it back together. That's really probably the first and most important part of the developer's job in these types of projects. And that putting it back together is where you start layering in that capital stack of understanding how you're going to deal with these things. And that's where, you know, whether there's certain governmental incentives that are available for that for that particular location that may not be available elsewhere. Maybe it's a new market tax credit area. Maybe you're in an opportunity zone. All of these factors come into play, and you have to go through them and really dive in. And it's important for the developers to be able to understand many, many different aspects of land development that include the environmental, but also all of these other factors that it takes to get into development of a site like this. And what I'll say before I pass it back to Warren is that, you know, Scott Miller said early on that the EPA doesn't control local land use. It's a perfect example of where the EPA has certain risk tolerances, but then DHEC has other risk tolerances. And as developers, we have to be able to understand what the needs of the EPA, DHEC, and the local government are in order to blend those together and find the right balance for getting the land use in a position where the site can move forward. So in this particular case, we actually decided on our own. Warren and I met with the county, and then we went back to DHEC and EPA, and we volunteered to not build any single family housing on this entire 240-acre site. And so that was a limitation when we went to get our land use approvals that we put upon ourselves to make DHEC and EPA's jobs easier.
So one of the things that I would say that would be a little bit of the secret sauce of why we were able to put this deal together, because this site had sat vacant for 20 years. And as DHEC can tell you, a lot of developers took a run at it and wanted to do it. Everyone knew that this is a 240-acre site, 2.5 miles from downtown Greenville. You know, just a little bit about this site, because we didn't really get into it before, but just to share with y'all, right here, you can see the arrow going down the side is the Swamp Rabbit Trail, which takes you right to downtown Greenville. And we have about a mile of frontage along the trail. So this is the largest undeveloped site within the greater downtown area. So it's obviously a highly sought after site. As Scott, someone previously said, it was one of the top 20, you know, Superfund sites primed for redevelopment. But the problem was no one could figure out how to put all the pieces together. And I think one of the things we began with, and no offense to the engineers that may be on the call or the lawyers, of which both Dean and I are lawyers, engineers and lawyers, which are heavily involved in EPA and Superfund sites, are trained by our nature in school to think certain ways. You know, when they go to law school, they break down how you previously read and wrote and thought and teach you that way. And engineering is a very similar discipline in the way they teach you to think and to approach problems. And, you know, the proverbial thinking outside the box doesn't even apply here. Here it's how do you turn a box into a circle? And one of the ways that Dean and I found success here was getting everybody in the room and listening to everyone from the engineers, to the attorneys, to county council, to the residents. And then as Dean will talk, you know, kind of bridging the gap across all that and putting all these pieces together. But it really involves, I mean, the amount of work that Dean and I would do as the developers was more than any other project we probably ever work on that would have been relegated to, you know, other professionals to handle. It really only worked if the two of us were the ones in the room or reading the documents to be able to connect the dots between everybody.
Go ahead, Dean. So, you know, bridging those gaps, it's really, it's about the different silos that all of the different agencies work within. And what has to happen is that there needs to be an entity or a person or people in this case that are able to break down the barriers between those silos so that everybody can work together. How do you get it where it's not just staying in their lane, but there's communication across these different agencies? And that is really what the developer's job ends up becoming in a project like this. And that's what Warren and I spent a lot of time doing in order to get the entitlements in place, in order to move the project forward from the standpoint of the record of decision that already happened and the ones that are currently happening. Earlier, Scott Martin mentioned the fact that he was moving forward with a record of decision for the entire site. And when Warren and I got involved and we ended up starting to work on the site with the EPA, DHEC, and our attorneys and other consultants, one of the very early discussions with Raylan Finch, who's one of the main counsel, the main attorneys that we worked with from DHEC on this project and we're still working with, was regarding our ability to break it down into components of areas where no further action was required at the time. And could we get those areas delisted to get early development starts going? That kind of thinking and process, that's helpful to these agencies, which by their very nature, they are not designed to be nimble. That's not their purpose. And sometimes people get frustrated with that, but that's part of the protections that our laws and our government create on purpose so that bad decisions don't get made and then they have to be fixed over and over again. The idea is that a developer, a private developer who can move quickly and do certain things that these agencies can't do, can also provide softballs that are within the lanes of what the agencies can do that ultimately help the developer continue to move everything forward at an advanced pace. Maybe not the pace that they thought initially. Maybe it is, but it's a different form. But the idea of working together and figuring those kinds of challenges out is what makes these redevelopment projects work. And that's the developer's job.
So as Dean was mentioning about the delisting, and I did some crude drawing here, and we have some time, so figured to help to walk everyone through the site. One of the challenges was this is a 240 acre site. How do you sort of take it all at once? And as it's when we started, this was all part of the Superfund site. And I think back to somebody, I read a book once and it was asking a mountain climber, how do you climb Mount Everest? And his answer was simple, one step at a time, you know, and just don't look at the top, just keep in front of you going one step at a time. So getting sort of creative and how do you round the square here? One of the economic challenges was if you took down all 240 acres and had to spend all the time getting it, you know, remediated, delisted, and ready for development, financially it never made sense. That's why every developer came with their hand out and said, how much money am I going to get from the government to do this project? And what we were able to do was roughly the areas in red were the areas that we were able to get delisted sooner, since there was no further action needed on those areas. And working with EPA and DHEC, and I mean, Dean can speak more about it, but they were just fantastic, you know, in working with us and taking, you know, all these ideas and making them happen. That then opens up 150 acres of the site for immediate development, which now makes it economically viable for a developer to come in and develop it because we don't have to wait 10 years, 15 years, or however long it takes for Congress to come around and fund the site. So by opening up those red areas right away, that was a key to sort of making this project happen. You know, Dean can talk more about the bottom left, the purple area is going to sort of be next. The orange areas were two other infill sites that were owned by someone else that were not part of the site that we acquired separately to sort of fill in the puzzle pieces here. But really the key to all of this was putting money at risk that was, you know, fully at risk from day one that Dean and I did to make it happen. You know, we were spending money on the engineers, on the lawyers, and it was not an insignificant amount, fully at risk without any level of certainty before we knew this project could happen. So instead of coming with our hands out, we contributed to the pot and said, all right, we'll pay to get the engineers, we'll pay to get, you know, some testing done. I think there was some testing, contaminant testing along the way that we paid for ourselves instead of waiting for EPA or DHEC to fund it. And that was important to moving this along. And Dean, maybe you can speak about kind of the vision of the master plan, since now we have this slide up. And
sure. So just kind of going backwards 1 second, I put a yellow box around one of where the little amphitheater piece is. And the reason that I did that is because it's a perfect example of where I mentioned earlier about the differences between risk analysis and the standards between the state and the federal government. And when you're working through the process and understanding the differences between state requirements and federal requirements for environmental cleanup, sometimes there's differences. So from an EPA standpoint, that's an area of no further action. However, that is the aeration lagoon where the chromium sludge was deposited. And that's an area where DHEC does want us to do cleanup in. We want to redevelop that area, as you can see. And so as a part of this process, it's a no further action under the EPA, but it's an area where we're going to continue to have to do cleanup in order to meet standards for the brownfield program under DHEC. So what we're actually doing is once it gets delisted, then we'll have it entered into the brownfield program of the state. And under that program, the voluntary cleanup program, we'll actually clean that area up. And so that's part of this dance that has to occur. And if you're gonna be able to do these redevelopments and do them the right way, I think that the easiest way to think about it is that you can't walk around with a sledgehammer and plan to beat your way through these agencies. You have to be part of the solution, and part of the solution is working in concert between them and understanding that they each have their own nuanced requirements that need to be met. And I'm sorry, Warren, you asked me to talk about one other thing, and I had that thought in my mind. Oh, our time's up. So with that, I think we're going to pass along to the next members of our team.
Good afternoon. Good morning, everybody. My name is David Reeser. I'm with the law firm of K&L Gates. I'm based in Chicago. With me is my colleague, Aaron Dargan, who is based in Charleston, South Carolina, and also Matt O'Gurek, who's our partner in New York. Matt is the transaction partner on this deal, and he brought us in because this is a great transaction, but it obviously had some environmental hair on it, which we needed to solve. So let's go to the first slide, please. So when Matt came and started talking to Dean, Dean says we'd like to build a big residential development on an NPL site. And I had this reaction because as an environmental lawyer who's been involved in remediation and redevelopment, that's probably the hardest problem to solve. Let's go to the next slide, please. And it's a hard problem to solve because it's the combination of very high level of liability, very likely high costs, and difficulty to get away from those things. So obviously the first problem is how do we get Dean and Warren to do what they want to do on the site and have this development happen without taking complete ownership of the property and thus ownership of all of the Superfund liability for remediation and for past costs. As you heard, EPA has been involved in the site for a number of years, and I don't know what their past costs are, but that would probably significant, and that's not something that anybody coming to the site to rebuild it would want to take on. The second issue is, how do we get the site out of the NPL? Obviously, development's next to impossible for a site on the NPL, plus under, as Perrin will talk about, a site on the NPL is not eligible for involvement in the DHAC brownfield program. We obviously have a timing issue because we needed to wait for EPA to complete some of its tasks, to complete its investigation, to complete its ROD. And as with any development project, time is money, and having a good idea of how long things are going to take is absolutely essential. And then the other problem, I'm turning this over to Perrin to discuss, is integrating the remediation costs into the development process. So Perrin, you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, this sort of gets to a point that Warren and Dean were talking about earlier. This is sort of opening up lines of communication between the different agencies and all the stakeholders, the EPA, the DHAC, our clients, the developers, and trying to solve some of these issues that we're faced with, one of which is these early remediation costs that our clients incurred that you heard Warren and Dean talking about a few minutes ago. How do we integrate those costs into the redevelopment process? And this is really an issue of us having early conversations with DHAC, getting DHAC, even though DHAC was involved in the site, we wanted DHAC brownfield, which wasn't historically involved with the site, to get involved with the site, because we knew eventually as these parcels got delisted, we were going to be enrolling them into the brownfield program. So we needed early and frequent conversations with the brownfield folks. And one of the things that we talked about with them was when our clients started to incur costs, remediation related costs to some of these sites as they were approaching delisting, we wanted that site assessment that we were undertaking at that point to be something that we would get credit for once we got into the brownfield program. Because once this site's moved from the NPL into the brownfield program, one of the big requirements that our clients are gonna have to undertake is to do a lot more site assessment of all of these parcels. And so when we're doing these early assessment activities and remediation activities, we wanted to be doing the kinds of things that would satisfy the EPA at that point, but that would also satisfy the concerns that we knew we would be encountering as we got into the brownfield program, so that we were essentially killing several birds with one stone. So again, to points that Warren and Dean were talking about earlier, it was important for us to be having conversations with the EPA and with DHEC, not just DHEC Superfund, but DHEC brownfields as early as possible, so that we could sort of know in advance what issues they would be concerned about and address those issues on the front end, rather than having to essentially reinvent the wheel once we got into the brownfield program.
Thanks, Perrin. Let's turn to the next slide, please. So fortunately, we had a lot of assets that we could turn to in order to make this process work. First and foremost is that the EPA's investigation showed that the site was actually mostly clean. The area immediately around the manufacturing facility was not, as we'll talk about, and there was still groundwater contamination. But the areas outside of that there were some issues, but they were essentially clean as far as EPA was concerned. And EPA was prepared to make that factual finding that no remedial action had to be performed there. And that established the prospect, as we'll talk about, for splitting off those portions of the site known as OU2 and make them available for much more immediate development and provide the potential for starting to bring cash in to fund the rest of the work. The second component of this is that EPA Region 4 was very motivated by the prospect of redevelopment, and that's not always the case. But they really saw an opportunity here. They saw an opportunity to take a site that didn't have viable responsible parties and turn it into something something great, something that was not just an eyesore and a big hole in the community, but actually was going to be something better that the community would really like. Our next asset was South Carolina, and Aaron's going to talk about this. It's a really favorable brownfields program, which includes a lot of liability relief that's not otherwise available. So, Aaron, why don't you talk about that, please?
Yeah, South Carolina does have a wonderful program, and you're going to hear some more. You've heard from some of the South Carolina DHEC people. You're going to hear later after us from some of the DHEC folks that are specifically within the brownfield program, including the director, Robert Hodges. But South Carolina does have a wonderful program, and it's operated by people who really do a great job. And it has broad liability protections that have only gotten broader since the program was first instituted about 20 years ago. It provides liability protection for non-responsible parties who come into a piece of property like this, like our clients did, who don't have any historic connection to the site or its contamination. They are awarded liability protection from the state against any liability to the state or the environmental agency in the state, and also against liability protection, broad liability protection against any third parties. So, for example, adjacent site owners, if there might ultimately be offsite migration of contamination from one of these parcels onto an adjacent site, our clients would have protection from liability for anything associated with that migration. So it does have very, as David alluded to, very broad liability protection, and also has some nice tax benefits to it. There's a state tax credit, state corporate income tax credit involved. There's a jobs tax credit. There's property tax exemptions available with concurrence from the local county government. There's also a revolving loan fund available. So there are lots of different funding incentives and tax-based incentives for the program as well. So you'll hear more about this as we go through it, but that's just sort of an introduction to some of the benefits of the program.
Okay. So another asset, and again, we've heard about this, we had Dean and Warren working on that. And in that, we had a developer who was really prepared to invest in the process. And by invest, I don't mean just money, although I assume that happened, but you had individuals who were prepared to not only talk to the community and talk to the governments, but more importantly, listen and use those meetings to develop a very high level of trust that what they were going to do was going to be a benefit to the community, that they would do what they would say they were going to do. And having that as a basis made a lot of the other work that we have to do a lot easier. So they invested, most importantly, themselves in this process. And by creating the coordination, by creating the links among all the different stakeholders, they were able to get this process moving in a way that sort of a regular developer just coming in from the outside and throwing money around would not have been able to do. So that was a huge benefit. Last thing is that we didn't have any other potentially responsible parties, and anyone who makes a business of being involved in PRP groups can tell you that that's a really good thing, because having a PRP group is kind of a pain in the butt for getting anything done. But the other component of this is that it's a tension within EPA primarily, between their brownfield people and the Superfund people, that if there are PRPs involved, there's much more of an enforcement type mindset, because the PRPs are by definition bad people, and they are responsible for not only cleaning up, but paying the, making sure the government is made whole, or the past costs are paid, and all of those things. And then, and if those are all goals, important goals to the government, and of course they are, then sometimes the things that need to be done for to make a development happen don't become as prominent, get complicated by the need to make sure that the PRPs do what the government thinks they're supposed to do. So let's go on to the next slide. And actually, this, the development discussion has pretty well been covered. So let's go to the next slide, please.
Wait, just, can David,
I'm sorry, Perrin, go ahead.
Yeah, this kind of gets to a sequencing issue. That in addition to the normal array of development considerations that a prospective purchaser of a site like this might take into consideration as it planned its development, their liability and work plan related issues that have to be factored into that. And Warren and Dan have both done an amazing job of understanding and embracing those pieces of the puzzle. And basically that, you know, as Warren and Dean sketched out for you on a similar slide to the one you're looking at now earlier, there are pieces of this property that have come out of or off of the national priorities list already, and we've already got admitted into the brownfield program. Those are the parcels that essentially you see there in red for the most part, and that are ready to go for development now. So they focus their development efforts on those parcels first. The sequencing had to go in that order because those are the parcels that they could take title to. One of the key threshold requirements for the South Carolina brownfield program is that participant requirements, which, as I mentioned, they have to be a non-responsible party, but they're also site requirements. So, and the site requirement that's in play here is that the site cannot be listed on the NPL in order to be admitted into the brownfield program. So the first sites delisted, these sites that you're looking at now, were the first sites that would be eligible to go into the brownfield program, and therefore the first sites that would be eligible for development. So that was a key factor in how they plan to sequence their development. And then they also, once they get into that, now they, Dean and Warren have requirements from DHAC to do site assessment activities out there, and those have to be incorporated into their development plans as well. So there's lots of considerations related to the environmentals that have to be factored into the development decisions and the sequencing of those development parcels going forward.
Okay, so let's go to the next slide. Thank you. So as we've talked about, this had to be broken down into phases. And the point was to get as many properties as possible out of the NPL and into the DHAC's brownfield program, where they would have much more extensive liability protections. So for the clean parcels, which are OU2, the first step was to get the EPA no action ROD, a determination by EPA that the site was clean as it needed to be for the varied uses that it was going to be made of. And while that's not necessarily a liability protection, it's the next best thing, because that's EPA saying, we're done here. Unless somebody shows something else, there's nothing more to do. The next thing we did, and not on the slide, but we got a status/comfort letter from EPA sort of reiterating the impact of the no action ROD on potential liability, and also saying that there wasn't any intention to go and execute liens on the property, because EPA has certain lien rights at Superfund sites. And then the next step, and Perrin will get into this, is to, once we got it out from under the EPA, the next step was to get it into the South Carolina brownfield program. So Perrin, why don't you talk about how that worked?
Sure. So as I said, we had to get the site or the parcels off of the NPL before we could get it admitted into the into the brownfield program, and we had to get it admitted into the brownfield program before Dean Warren's or a group could take title to the property, because that's a timing issue that's very important in the South Carolina brownfield program, is that once you take title to the property, you essentially become a responsible party, which would then make you ineligible for the brownfield program. So they had to get the newly delisted sites admitted into the brownfield program first, and then take title to the property. The other tension there was that, somebody mentioned earlier, site was there was a receiver appointed, and the receiver took control of the property. The receiver, of course, his incentive is to liquidate the property as soon as he can. But we can't help him do that. We can't take title to the property until we get admitted into the brownfield program. So we're trying to walk a fairly fine line between getting the property delisted and getting it into the brownfield program, and still honoring the receiver's desire to transfer title as soon as possible. So we had to make sure that those things took place in that order. And now that we've gotten it admitted into the brownfield program, taken title to some of the parcels, we're in the process of developing a work plan with DHEC, which will allow us to then begin actually doing all the site assessment activities and some of the remediation activities that Dean and Warren were talking about earlier. So that's sort of the sequence that had to happen, from delisting through admission into the program to taking title to ultimately beginning the work plan and beginning to do the early stages of development work.
Okay. Let's go to the next slide, please. So for the not so clean air parcels, it's a different story. This is primarily the manufacturing area, and this does need to be remediated, and we can't delist and get it out from under EPA without doing that work. So we put together an agreed work plan, and we're in the process of entering into a prospective purchaser agreement with EPA. And that is a liability protection document that EPA enters into with prospective purchasers like this one to give liability protection while they do the work. And it actually reads much more like a consent decree than, in my opinion, that it ought to, but that's the nature of that particular beast. So there is an agreement by the prospective purchaser to do the work that's identified in an attached scope of work, and to put up financial assurance and to agree to be responsible, essentially, for performing the work. So we are negotiating the terms of that document now, and then once we complete the remedial work required by that document, and once EPA determines that that work's been satisfactorily completed and that we pay EPA's response costs for those activities, then EPA will determine that it's done. And at that point, they will work to delist the property. And then after all that's done, then we can turn around and enter the DHEC Brownfields program. So, Perrin, why don't you finish up on what needs to be done there?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially the same issue I was just talking about. So once these parcels under OU1 are reach that point where the work prescribed by the ROD is accomplished and those parcels are delisted, again, same issue, we'll be able to enter those the parcels into the brownfield program, just like the ones we recently entered in, and take titles of the property, and then begin that path down, creating a work plan along with DHEC, and then embarking on conducting that work.
Okay. So next slide, please. And we're short time, so I'm going to roll through these pretty quickly. OU3 is the groundwater, and that will remain EPA responsibility. In under the Superfund program, we were able to split that off as an entity for liability protection purposes from the rest of the project, but for the state purposes, we were not able to do it. So let's go to the next slide. So we've gone through these liability protections, but just to sum up, for OU2, we have the no action rod, we have the EPA Superfund comfort and status letter, and we are now in the process of entering into the DHEC Brownfields program. For OU1, the PPA is the main source of the liability protection, and that provides both covenants not to sue, where EPA is agreeing not to sue the company as long as they do the work that's required, and also contribution protection, which means that other entities who have incurred response costs cannot bring an action against the company for those response costs. And finally, this includes a lien waiver, which takes care of the potential for EPA to collect under its statutory liens. And then we have the protection again under the DHEC Brownfields. Next slide, please. Just the last slide. So what are the lessons learned here? Quickly, and Perrin and I are going to move back and forth on it. Quickly, the first thing is to pick the right site. So this site turns out had a lot of benefits. Part of it was fairly clean, and it was also in South Carolina, which in and of itself was a benefit. Perrin?
And this on that note, this site, and Robert can shed some light on this as well. This is either the first or second largest brownfield site in the history of the South Carolina program, which has been around for about 20 years. And I think there have been something on the order of 1,000 sites, 600 or so non-responsible party sites. And it's depending on how you aggregate the acreage, it's either the first or second largest in the history. So it's an exciting, really exciting project for those of us working on it as lawyers, as well as I think for DHEC and for the EPA and for Warren and Dean. It's just been a really fun project. It's been a wonderful site.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has been a fun site to work on. So the other lessons are ones that everybody has talked about here, which is investing in the process and being involved in the community. A big chunk of the environmental justice issue has to do with people not being not taking the time to do what Dean Warren did, which was get into the community, talk about what their needs were, follow up on their needs, listen to their concerns, and develop a project that was consistent with community goals. And then the last one is to develop a plan to participate in state brownfields program. And Perrin, you can talk about that.
Yeah, the protections that our clients, Dean and Warren, are getting on this project from the EPA are wonderful. The great liability protections for potential future liability to the EPA for pre-existing contamination, but they don't cover everything. And that's where the state program in South Carolina is so good, because it's pretty aggressive in picking up or plugging the rest of the liability holes that are out there. So between the EPA liability protections and the PPAs, and the liability protections of the South Carolina program, which includes liability, as I said, against third parties, really does provide a wonderful array of protections against liability for pre-existing contaminations here. So it's great that those two programs in this instance and really, really dovetail beautifully together.
That's great. So I'm going to give Matt the last word here. We have probably less than a minute, if that. But he can talk about the overall transaction.
Yeah, thanks a lot, David and Perrin. I'm Matt O'Gurek. I'm in the New York office of K&L Gates, which is a global law firm. But as you can see in this case, a firm with local experience, especially with this project. When Dean and Warren came to me with this idea, I know these guys. They're extremely creative, but they're also cordial. And very respectful of the environment in which they're working in. So I have to echo the fact that, getting the community buy-in, being able to get everybody together and on the same page and feeling comfortable and trustworthy with one another, that we can actually get a deal done here that benefits the community and everybody. It made my job a lot easier for certain, which was to get a PSA, signed up, get something in writing, with receiver seller to get this deal off the ground. And as a result of the trust, you know, that was a very easy negotiation. The we were able to negotiate long diligence and investigative periods, and were able to also, you know, close on those parcels that we could close on, and, you know, escrow in a dry escrow closing sort of way, you know, future closings, which is a really interesting way of approaching this. As parcels are released from the NPL, we'll proceed to close on those when the time is right. So overall, a huge success and for our firm and for the project, and you know, just a great success. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for listening, and we're here for questions.
Thank you.
Hi, hello everyone. I'm Robert Hodges. I manage the Brownfields program here in South Carolina. I want to thank everyone earlier for all the kind words. I do want to say that a dance such as this, going from Superfund sites to beautiful revitalization efforts, is, as everyone has mentioned, takes quite a bit of choreography and everyone avoiding stepping on each other's feet. Although this property was on the federal Superfund, it's not eligible for brownfields. We made the decision that we're willing to go ahead and start expending state's resources in advance, mostly because of all the reasons you've heard so far. We had a high level of comfort for a strong potential for success. So we were moving before the property was eligible for brownfields to get it prepared to enter into it, so that when the delisting occurred, we could move immediately into state brownfields programs. The state brownfields program in South Carolina, the mechanism is what we call the voluntary cleanup contract. This slide shows an excerpt from our state Hazardous Waste Management Act, the law that provides the brownfields program. It was adopted soon after CERCLA was amended to create the brownfields programs across in the federal side. But in our state, the highlighted spot here is basically the fulcrum of what we do. Our state law says that we can accept work plans and reports that don't require the removal of all contamination. That's the brownfields protections. A non-responsible party will not be required to do a remediation, complete remediation. However, they do have to take steps. But we can allow this to occur without full remediation if, And as you can see here, the four little talking dots that give us the ifs. And the third one you will see does not interfere with or substantially increase cost of continuing response action. And the second talking dot says does not contribute or exacerbate. So that's sort of our role in the future process once you're in the brownfields program. We'll review work plans and reports and make sure that all these actions are in compliance with the Brownfields Act. So let's get the next one, please. Next slide. And this is an excerpt from the contract that we have entered into for this site, the Cone Mill site. And we've got innovative here also. Normally, our contract describes the complete assessment that we will look for on a property so that we can help design the measures to make it safe for the intended use. But as this project differs in so many ways, and the main one is the phased approach, we are working with Jason's group here. He's going to explain this in a few minutes, but what we're doing is we're going to work our contract in a phased approach. So as each portion of the property moves into the development, we will then design the assessment work plan for that portion. So we don't try to approach this project, this property, as one giant property. Each development area will have an individual assessment plan, assessment work, then protective measures, any corrective actions that may be required. And we move through, and we can provide a certificate of completion, which is the endpoint of the Brownfields contract, for each parcel as we move forward into the future. So the developers get their protections as they develop. So with this, I'm going to let Jason give a further explanation of the work plan and the type of assessment work that we're going to be asking to be done at this property. So we know that this development will be the best one in the state to date. Jason.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jason Sheasley. I'm a geologist with Kimley Horn and Associates, and we're the environmental consultant for the developer for this project. And like most Brownfields projects, this project started with a phase one environmental site assessment and then evolved from there. We actually prepared three separate phase one ESAs for the project. The first one was completed in August of 2020. That was updated in 2021. And the third one was recently completed in February of 2022, prior to the acquisition of the parcels that made up the former OU2 area, Operation Unit 2 area. With a lot of industrial sites and we're preparing phase ones, one of the biggest challenges is trying to piece together the operational history of the site. But that wasn't necessarily the case in this instance. Through all the work that the EPA and DHEC performed over the years, there was a lot of operational history and knowledge about the site. However, in preparing our phase one, we didn't rest or rely entirely on that data. We did our own research and evaluation with the understanding that we were going to either confirm, refute, or add to the narratives that have been developed by both the EPA and DHEC regarding the Cone Mill site. As it related to the phase one itself and the subject property was listed to the parcels that made up the former OU2 area. However, the majority of the phase one did speak to the larger area of the Superfund site. The EPA previously evaluated the site and identified roughly 18 areas of concern and three operational units. Those three operational units included operational unit one, which was the main plant area, operational unit number two, which was the area outside of the main plant, and then operation unit three, which was limited to the groundwater contamination. So as Robert had mentioned earlier, part of the voluntary cleanup contract program was the development of the work plan to do the further site assessment under the Brownfields program. However, since we're developing the site in phases and the development plans for all of the components of the project have yet to be finalized, it really didn't make sense to develop and put together a comprehensive work plan that would ultimately be amended and modified through the course of the completion of the development plans. So instead, we developed, as Robert alluded to, a sampling plan. And this sampling plan essentially established the overall goals of the future work plans that would be developed for the site. And it was a way for both the developer and DHEC to come to a consensus regarding the type of sampling that would be performed, the contaminants of concern, and the overall phasing approach for the development of the project. For instance, the sampling plan speaks to the instances in which discrete sampling would be performed versus instances in which incremental sampling methodology would be performed for soil analysis and characterization. It also spoke to the fact that the EPA is going to retain responsibility for addressing the groundwater contamination. However, under the future work plans that would be developed, we would be, or there would be, a component of groundwater assessment and potentially groundwater monitoring under the state's brownfields program. And one of the most important things that the sampling plan did was that it established the development areas for the former OU2 area. So we have five development areas that were identified. The first is Area 1, Development Area 1, and that corresponds with Area of Concern 1, which is the permitted sludge landfill. The second area is Development Area 2, and that corresponds with AOC 15, which was the northwestern reservoir area. The third area corresponds with AOC 14, which is a northern reservoir. And the fourth area, which is identified or on this exhibit, corresponds with AOC 17, which was identified as the forested tract. And finally, the last area is a development area, is Area 5. This is an area that is just south of the main plant area that was not really part of the main operations and was singled out or separated out from the main Superfund process earlier in the program or earlier in the process implemented by the EPA. So each of these areas, when we identified or carved up these areas, was based on the proposed or intended redevelop on those areas. The one thing to take into consideration is the amount of significant work that will be done just to evaluate operation unit or operation area 2. Next slide, please. This site is not flat. There's a lot of topographic relief across the site. In fact, this shows a portion of the development area and the topography. We will need to do a significant amount of earthwork, and part of the work plans that will be developed under the sampling plan will address the initial site plan and soil management. We anticipate that we'll be managing up to 500,000 cubic yards, 500,000 cubic yards of soil across the site. There'll be some areas on site where we'll be cutting down the topographic highs as much as 5 to 10 feet. There are other areas on the site where we'll be filling in topographic lows as much as 5 to 10 feet. So there's a significant amount of earthwork to be done across across the entire site as a whole, but also on operation unit area 2, which is really the focus of the sampling plan. As was alluded to earlier, there's really two components at play here. There is first the work to be done under the voluntary cleanup program with DHEC, but then there's also the work to be done under a work share program or prospective purchase agreement through the EPA for the main plant area. So in addition to developing the future work plans for the OU2 area, we're also in the process of developing a work plan for the main plant. And the work to be concluded in the main plant area, as were alluded to previously in the presentation, includes evaluating the chromium contamination underneath the main slab, main building slab area. Also looking at remaining asbestos within the existing buildings, asbestos and lead-based paint. As was alluded to by Dean, there's an area on site where some of the asbestos was disposed of during the emergency actions shortly after the fire. That will also be evaluated. We'll also be looking at the larger aeration lagoon area and looking at managing the sludge in the aeration lagoon area and decommissioning that area as well. Thankfully, a lot of the data that's been collected to date indicates that there's not a lot of significant contamination across the site, which is to say that we're really not dealing with hazardous waste. There's contamination present. It consists primarily of metals, arsenic, lead, chromium in both soil and groundwater. There's also some VOCs or semi-volatile organic compounds and volatile organic compounds at certain AOCs, and then smaller areas their PCB contamination to contend with. But fortunately, as I mentioned, we're really not talking about a lot of extensive areas of contamination. It's really focused in on the areas of concern that were previously identified by the EPA. And each of the work plans, whether it's the work plan under that are developed under DHEC or the work plan that's developed under the WorkChamp program under the EPA, will really focus in and go back into those areas of concern and better define the extent of contamination so that we can ultimately develop remedial action plans and a remedial strategy for addressing the contaminants that are present. With that being said, we're not really anticipating any active remediation with possible exception of the groundwater contamination. What we're really anticipating here is a lot of passive remedial strategies, and that would include the use of engineering and institutional controls. As was mentioned earlier by Dean, one of the concessions that was made is that the development of the site would not include any single family residential developments. However, we will be doing a lot of multifamily residential developments. And so as part of the work plan and ultimately the remedial action plans, we'll need to demonstrate that the soil that's being relocated and reused in those areas are commensurate with that intended land use. In some areas, we'll be using up to 2 or 3 feet of clean soil to cap green space areas. And other areas will rely on impervious surfaces, such as building pads, roadways, and sidewalks to encapsulate contaminated soil that might be present. So there are a lot of moving parts and pieces associated with this project that we're trying to capture under each of the work plans that are being developed. And going forward, those work plans will be implemented on a phased approach, as was indicated. We're not developing this site all at once. We're taking small bites of the elephant, you're consuming the elephant one bite at a time. And so both under the DHEC approach and the EPA approach, we're gonna come into this and take those small steps that are necessary to develop each of the individual areas as appropriate. I've worked on a lot of development projects, a lot of brownfields projects throughout my 30 years in the industry. And I can honestly say that this is one of the most unique projects that I've worked on. Dean and Warren have assembled a tremendous team to develop this site. They have some incredible vision for the future redevelopment of this site. And it's really, I think this will be a textbook example of brownfields redevelopment that'll be referred to in the future going forward. I know I'm excited to be a part of this project, and I know a lot of the other folks that spoke today are also excited to be part of that project. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Scott Miller to wrap things up.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate that. Thank you to all of our speakers. We are looking forward to seeing the continued collaboration and redevelopment of the site in the coming years. I want to take a few minutes to provide an overview of available resources and contacts for Superfund redevelopment before we jump into our question and answer session. You may be wondering what EPA can do to help facilitate reuse at Superfund sites. EPA has a host of tools and resources such as technical assistance and reuse planning, guidance, handbooks, fact sheets, prospective purchaser inquiry calls, comfort status letters that you heard mentioned, EPA agreements. If you have questions about how to get reuse-related support for a site or have questions about redeveloping a Superfund site, don't hesitate to reach out to me or the EPA Regional Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator for your area. I want to highlight Superfund Redevelopment Program's technical assistance and reuse planning support. Each year, EPA Superfund's redevelopment program sets aside resources to provide technical assistance to communities or specific stakeholders. Technical assistance is one of the most flexible tools that EPA has for supporting reuse. Oftentimes, technical assistance resources support reuse planning work. SRP provides several different types of reuse planning services. These projects thoughtfully and thoroughly engage communities, providing key information that informs agency decision-making regarding site cleanup and potential Superfund redevelopment opportunities. These projects lay the foundation for new reuses, leading to strengthened local economies and much needed community amenities. I also want to highlight the newest Superfund redevelopment tool. It's called EPA Superfund Redevelopment Mapper. This tool is the latest EPA resource developed to help revitalize Superfund sites. The Mapper is a web-based mapping tool created to help a variety of stakeholders explore reusing and redeveloping land on or near Superfund sites. The Mapper helps stakeholders explore potential reuse opportunities through providing users with Superfund site locations and key information highlighting site features and surrounding area characteristics. Climate layers such as flood hazard areas can be added to the Mapper as well. EPA strives to provide this key information to stakeholders so they can make informed decisions for land reuse compatible with local land use requirements, community needs, and priorities. EPA divides the U.S. into 10 regions to support implementation of EPA's programs, including the Superfund program. Every EPA region has a Superfund redevelopment coordinator who serves as a local contact for your state or area. I am listed for Region 4, as are my counterparts Joy Deb Majumder and Shelby Johnston. Redevelopment coordinators can answer questions about Superfund redevelopment as well as connect you with EPA tools and resources. If you have questions or are looking for support, don't hesitate to reach out to your region's coordinator. If you have any general questions or would like more information about Superfund redevelopment, please don't hesitate to contact myself, Alexis Rourke-Reyes, currently on detailed HQ for the Superfund redevelopment program, or Chelsea Sibidich. If you would like to sign up to receive information about Superfund redevelopment webinars and other news, please use the link to be added to the mailing list. Without further delay, let's open it up for a question and answer session, Josie.
Great. Thank you so much, Scott. Appreciate all the presenters today. I think we do have a few questions that we can ask and pose. Let me open up the chat here. So one of the questions that came in was hoping for a little bit of background about how a Miami developer would become aware of and successfully lead the redevelopment of a site in upstate South Carolina. Dean or Warren, do you want to chime in?
Sure, I can take that. It's actually a funny story. Dean and I were up in South Carolina looking for industrial projects, and we were meeting with our broker who happened to have the listing for the receiver on this site. And somebody walked in the room and kind of made a comment, oh, did you show them the Cone Mills site? You know, show them that one. And our broker said, well, it's a perfect site if you like brain damage and challenges. I think that was his quote. And that was all Dean and I needed to hear was we love brain damage and challenges. So he showed us the site. And from there, that's where we went. That was 2 years ago.
Great. I think the people appreciate having a little bit of background. Let's see here. So I think we did go over some of the specifics about protection from potential action from EPA, but I'll go ahead and pose this anyway. Has the developer received a comfort letter that EPA Region 4 will not impose a windfall lien to collect response costs for the work that EPA has currently undertaken or will take in the future?
The answer to that is yes. It's not a final determination on windfall liens, but it is a statement that the EPA sees no basis to assert a windfall lien. There's two different types of liens, and just given the nature, well, given some particularities about the property, one of the liens doesn't even apply, but the second lien might. But EPA has said that they, in their comfort letter, that they don't intend to work to assert a lien. And that's also an issue that's addressed in the PPA.
Great. Thank you, David. I think that covers that question. This might be a question for Scott Miller. Someone is hoping for more information about EPA's top 20 sites for redevelopment. They're wondering if that site is frequent, that list rather, is frequently updated, or how sites are added to that list. Do you know if that's a list that's being currently updated, Scott?
Josie, I don't believe that list is has been updated since it was originally published.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that there is an intent to do so moving forward, but we can check into that.
Great. We can always follow up with that participant later if we have more information that we can provide.
Okay.
All right. I'm seeing some comments coming in, thanking the presenters for the presentation today. If anyone else has any more content-related questions, please go ahead and put them into the chat. We would appreciate that. I'll also take this moment to highlight that in the chat, I added a link to a form where you can enter your information and be added to a mailing list, a email mailing list, for more information about the Superfund redevelopment webinars, conferences, tools, and other updates. So if you follow that link and enter your information, you'll be added to the list, and information about future webinars and other new tools like that redevelopment mapper will be sent to you. So please do feel free to add your information to that list. Not seeing any other questions coming in here. I think that you guys pretty much answered everyone's thoughts and questions that they might have. Anyone have any closing remarks that they would like to add since we have a little more time? Not to put anyone on the spot. Okay, I think we have had another question about contamination. So maybe this is one for Scott or Jason. Would someone summarize the types of contaminants that were present on the site?
This is Scott Martin. Yeah, there's a wide variety. The main issue remaining is the groundwater, that the main contaminant of concern there is chromium. There are other components in there. PCBs were an issue at the site, volatile organic compounds, various metals. There's quite a list of contaminants, but as you can see, most of them, the concentrations didn't rise to a level of warranting action to eliminate risk at the site by EPA.
Jason, would you like to add to that? I see that you came on video.
Yeah, sure. I'll just add that the most common contaminant that is identified across the site throughout all of the areas of concern really were various metals. In addition to the facility investigation work that the EPA performed under the state brownfields program, we'll be doing additional site assessment and helping to further define those contaminants of concern for each of the individual development areas. Right now, we're looking at a handful of metals, some volatile organic compounds, a couple semi-volatile organic compounds, and as Scott alluded to, also some PCBs. So we're still trying to iron that out going forward. But again, the main takeaway is that the levels of contamination are certainly manageable. Manageable to the point that the site can be redeveloped while at the same time being protective of human health and the environment.
Great. Thank you, Jason. And thank you, Scott. All right. I'm seeing more positive feedback about the presentation filter in, but no more current questions at the moment. I'll open the floor back up to any of the presenters who would maybe like to close with some thoughts, if you have anything else you'd like to add.
Yeah, this is Aaron. I'll add something. One of the things that I think we talk about a project like this, and we frequently talk about the problems that we might have encountered and that sort of thing. But one of the things that I love about a project like this, and this one was particularly this way, is it really didn't, I mean, it presented some problems or some difficulties, but what it really presented was some great opportunities. And working with a great team like Warren and Dean, and going to the working with the EPA, working with the state agency, DHEC, it really is a delight. And this is one of the few areas in my 30 years of practicing law that is really kind of almost completely non-adversarial. It, when we show up with David and I show up with clients like Dean and Warren with a brownfield project, and we talk to the EPA and we talk to DHEC, they're actually happy to see us, which is not true in other areas of our work. So it really has been a delight, and it's been a wonderful opportunity and a series of wonderful opportunities for redevelopment for a great site, as Warren and Dean highlighted, it very close to a really vital, growing downtown area in Greenville, and this only is going to add to what's already a great, vibrant, and growing community. So it really has been a real pleasure professionally to have been associated with this project and to continue on with the project into the future.
Great. Thanks, Perrin. I have a couple of more questions related to the contamination, just clarifying questions. Regarding the chromium, was it hexavalent chromium?
There's a hexavalent chromium, and we also look at total chromium.
Okay. And Scott, great. A couple other questions. Any evidence of vapor intrusion on the site?
No, not to date. We haven't, as the site isn't in reuse, it hasn't been a concern. But as the site moves forward with redevelopment, we will have to take a closer look at possible vapor intrusion issues if there's development above the plume. But right now, it's not an issue.
Okay. So we have a question about communicating safety to the local community. How do you communicate safety of the parts of the site removed from the MPL with the number of contaminants on nearby sections of the site and in the groundwater? So when let me to rephrase that a little bit. When a part of the site is removed from the MPL, how do you communicate the safety of that part of the site to the local community in regards to the contaminants?
I can take that. The first thing is that when we enter into, in this particular instance, we're being taken off of the national priority list and then entering those portions of the site into the state's brownfield program. So remember earlier you heard from two different portions of DHEC. You heard from the Superfund side of DHEC and the brownfield side. So we essentially we're working with two different departments within DHEC. And when we transfer over to the brownfield program side, part of that requires that we put up signage and that we keep that signage posted throughout the process as we go through and clean up that particular portion of the site and get to a no further action for that area. So until and unless that happens, we have to have that signage up and explain to people what's going on. And then in addition to that, during the process of the actual work, there may be other requirements that are specific to a certain area, specific to certain contaminants that will be part of our work plan that we provide, that we will have safety mechanisms and safety reporting and requirements in place as we go. And then the last thing that I'd like to layer on top of that is that what we have done is that even after we met the requirements of community outreach in the planning and zoning side of the world, we have continued to have those community outreach meetings. In fact, we just had one, I believe it was about a week ago. We actually asked for the EPA to attend that meeting. Scott Martin from the EPA was actually in that. We did a Zoom meeting with the community that was really well received. We also had local county council members in that meeting as well. So again, I think it's about a couple of different things. The statutorily required postings, the plans that are approved by the agencies, and then also the ongoing community outreach.
And Dean, I'll follow up with one additional step that'll be taken in towards the end of the brownfield program, is that we'll talk with DHEC once we've completed all the site assessment work and remediation work, and we're approaching that time, which we'll get our certificate of completion. We'll talk to DHEC about some restrictive covenants that will go on the site so that there will be certain uses going into the future that won't be allowed based on existing contamination beneath soil caps or any remaining groundwater contamination. There may be a restriction against groundwater use, for example, and that sort of thing. So once Dean and Warren and their group start to sell parcels off to sub-developers, there'll be certain things from a safety perspective that they will not be able to do with the property.
Great. Thanks for that information, Dean and Perrin. See a couple more questions here, time allowing. Would you consider this to be a green infrastructure renewal project in any way?
So we actually, you know, from the standpoint of renewables and doing live well, a fit well community, LEED certifications, all of those different types of aspects and certifications, being that it's a redevelopment site, we get a lot of those credits already. And we actually have a consultant that's part of our team that is their focus, and determining what credits we're entitled to and what we can pass along to the individual sites and how we can do that. So it is a part of the overall project and a part of the story as this continues to grow. And then how that gets integrated into the long-term nature of the site, it's an ongoing process. So the answer is yes. How far we take that for individual developments within the site is, it's a little bit different between the neighborhood side of it and the individual development side. That could be a whole webinar unto itself.
Great. Thanks, Dean. So let's touch on another question related to the contamination and how it will be dealt with during redevelopment. How will the on-site landfill be addressed in the redevelopment? And there's a follow-up question of, was the river and creek sediment contaminated?
So as it relates to the permitted sludge landfill, the material or the landfill itself contained sludge from the aeration lagoon and other processes in the manufacturing facility. And what we found, we've done some limited investigation, and what we found is that the material, the sludge material itself was relatively thin. It was placed in layers, allowed to dry, and then backfilled with soil. And so there's multiple layers of this sludge material. And then there's about anywhere from 5 to maybe 8 feet of overburden material on top of the sludge. One concern is that the material itself may not be geotechnically suitable to remain on site or be left in a particular area of the site where we may have significant geotechnical requirements. So one approach that we're looking at is to excavate that material, blend it with the overburden materials so that it's made more geotechnically suitable, and then relocate that to the northwestern reservoir area. As I mentioned, we're going to be filling a lot of some large areas of the site, as much as 10 to 15 feet will be backfilling areas. And that northwestern reservoir area happens to be one of those areas. This material under the Brownfields program will be able to put that into the reservoir area because it's above the water table, and then place 10 to 15 feet of soil on top of it and essentially encapsulate it and get it out of the way from an area where we're looking to redevelopment.
Great. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate that response.
And there was another question, I think, about the creek.
Yes. Was the river and creek sediment contaminated?
Yes, as part of, and Scott could probably speak in more detail, but as part of the facility investigation work that the EPA did, they did extensive sampling, sediment sampling, water quality sampling within the creek itself.
Great. Well, Gene, I think that we've pretty much hit our time limit here. I want you to be able to get to your very important end of webinar messages. So I want to thank everyone for the questions that they've submitted into the chat. We have a record of all of them. So if we need to follow up with folks after the webinar, we will. Once again, thank you so much for participating.
All right. Thank you so very much, Josie. And thanks to all of the presenters who shared their time and expertise today. I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders before we formally close out today's live broadcast. Just as we do at the end of each of our sessions, I'd like to welcome those of you who joined us to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org. You'll see a variety of icons that will allow you to connect with us by signing up for our RSS feeds, subscribing to our podcast, we are available in iTunes, as well as our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that I send out on the first of each month. And we tend to highlight sessions like today's webinar. So if you're interested in learning more, I also encourage you to become a subscriber for Tech Direct. One of the other things that I'd like to point out is just to remind everybody that the seminar homepage for this event is currently available from today forward. So it's the URL that's shown in red on this slide. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material or want to pull down some of the links or information about our speakers, all of that contact information, materials, links, those have already been posted and will remain posted on the seminar homepage shown at the above URL. And on that homepage, you'll also find a link to our feedback form. One of the most common questions I get is if we're offering CEUs or PDHs. While we don't issue those types of credit hours for our webinars, we can provide you with a participation certificate if you fill out the feedback form. So if you would like one of those certificates, simply follow the link to the feedback form. Make sure you click the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire live delivery or replayed the whole archive. And then when you submit your feedback form, you'll immediately have access to download or print out a copy of that participation certificate. If you happen to have multiple people joining at your location, all you need to do is get them the link to the seminar homepage so they can fill out the feedback form on their own and they can get their own certificate even though they may not have registered individually. And although you will have the option to download the certificate and we also email a copy, I usually encourage people download it from the confirmation screen. Sometimes the email copy can get caught up in junk or spam filters. And for those of you who are replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, the link shown here on the slide is still active. So you can also fill out that feedback form based off of your replay of today's archive and get a certificate based off of your watch of the archive session. There should also be a helpful button to it showing up in the archive right now, just above my head here in the upper right corner. So with that, I'll thank all of the participants who joined us for today's session, who shared questions and comments. I want to thank again all of our speakers and our amazing support staff, including Josie Torres on from SCIO, for helping make today's session happen.